Destruction of the Trade Towers, a lecture by David Ray Griffin on October 15, 2005. Dr. Griffin has been a professor of philosophy of religion at the Claremont Colleges in Southern California and is the author of over 20 books, 20 of which are on the subject of 9/11, the new Pearl Harbor, disturbing questions about the Bush administration in 9/11, and the 9/11 Commission Report, Omissions and Distortions. Previously, Dr. Griffin did not speculate on the collapse of the World Trade Center buildings. With new evidence, as explained in this program, Dr. Griffin states that the trade towers fell as a result of explosives inside the buildings, including the much-ignored Building 7, a 47-story high-rise that collapsed within 8 hours of the Twin Towers. Recorded in October at the Anthology Film Archive in New York City, here is David Ray Griffin.
In my first book on 9/11, The New Pearl Harbor, I summarized dozens of facts and reports that contradicted the official story about 9/11. Then in my second book, The 9/11 Commission Report, Omissions and Distortions, I showed how the 9/11 Commission dealt with all those facts and reports, that is, by distorting a few of them and simply omitting the rest of them. So I've been giving a cumulative argument, a big picture approach, and there's a real advantage to this big picture approach because it shows that no matter where you begin with the official story, it's problematic, and that's very important to realize. But one problem with this big picture approach is it means that the treatment of each issue must be quite brief and therefore superficial. And that leaves the way open for skeptics to suspect that maybe if we looked a little more deeply into one of these issues, we'd see the official story made sense after all. And so today, I'm going to focus on one question and one question only. Why did the Twin Towers and Building 7 of the World Trade Center collapse? One advantage of this focus, besides the fact that it will allow us to go into this issue in some detail, is that the destruction of the World Trade Center, I have become convinced, provides one of the best, perhaps the best, window into the truth about 9/11. Another advantage of this focus is that it will allow us to look at the revelations that are contained in the 9/11 oral histories, which were recorded by the New York Fire Department shortly after 9/11, but were released to the public only this past August. So I will begin with the question of the Twin Towers and then later talk about Building 7. Shortly after 9/11, President Bush advised people not to tolerate outrageous conspiracy theories about the attacks of 9/11. Philip Zelikow, who directed the 9/11 Commission, has likewise warned against outrageous conspiracy theories. What do these men mean by this phrase? They cannot mean that we should reject all conspiracy theories about 9/11 because the official theory is itself a conspiracy theory. They only mean that we should reject outrageous theories. But what is the difference between an outrageous theory and a non-outrageous theory? This is one of the central questions in the philosophy of science. When confronted by rival theories, let's say neo-Darwinian evolution and intelligent design, scientists and philosophers of science ask which theory is better and why. The mark of a good theory is that it can explain in a coherent way all or at least most of the relevant facts and is contradicted by none of them. A bad theory is one that is contradicted by some of the relevant facts. An outrageous theory would be one that is contradicted by virtually all of the relevant facts. With this definition in mind, let us look at the official theory about the Twin Towers, which says that they collapsed because of the combined effect of the impact of the airplanes plus the resulting fires. The later report put out by FEMA said the structural damage sustained by each tower from the impact, combined with the ensuing fires, resulted in the total collapse of each building. This theory clearly belongs to the category of outrageous theories because it is contradicted by all the relevant facts. Now, that may seem like an extreme statement to some of you, but I will try to show why it is not. The official theory is rendered implausible by two major problems. The first is the simple fact that fire has never, prior to nor after 9/11, caused steel-framed high-rise buildings to collapse. Defenders of the official theory seldom, if ever, mention this simple fact. Indeed, the supposedly definitive report put out recently by NIST, the National Institute for Standards and Technology, even implies that fire-induced collapses of large steel frame buildings are normal events. But far from being normal, such collapses had never occurred. Defenders of the official theory, of course, say that the collapses were caused not simply by the fires, but from the fires combined with the impact from the airplanes. The towers, however, were designed to withstand the impact of airliners about the same size as a Boeing 767. Hyman Brown, the construction manager of the Twin Towers, said they were over-designed to withstand almost anything, including hurricanes, bombings, and an airplane hitting them. And even Thomas Eagar, an MIT professor of materials and engineering science who supports the official theory, says that the impact of the airplanes would not have been significant because the number of columns lost on the initial impact was not large and the loads were shifted to remaining columns in this highly redundant structure. Likewise, the NIST report, in discussing how the impact of the airliners played a role, focuses primarily on the claim that the planes dislodged a lot of the fireproofing material from the steel. So the official theory of the collapse is essentially a fire theory. So it cannot be overemphasized that fire has never caused large steel frame buildings to collapse. Never, whether before 9/11 or after 9/11 or on 9/11 anywhere else in the world except allegedly New York City. Never. One might say, of course, there is a first time for everything, and that a really significant fire, an extraordinary fire, might induce a collapse. Well, let's look at this possibility. What would count as an extraordinary fire? Given the characteristics of steel, the fire would need to be very hot, very big, and very long-lasting. But the fires in the towers did not have one, let alone all three, of these characteristics. There have been claims, to be sure, that the fires were very hot. Some television specials claimed that the towers collapsed because the fire was hot enough to melt steel. For example, an early BBC special said, quoting a man presented as a structural engineer, "It was the fire that killed the buildings. There's nothing on earth that could survive those temperatures with that amount of fuel burning. The columns would have melted." But that claim is absurd. Steel does not begin to melt until it reaches almost 2,800 degrees Fahrenheit. And yet open fires fueled by hydrocarbons such as kerosene, which is what essentially jet fuel is, can at most rise to 1,700 degrees Fahrenheit. So we're about 1,100 degrees short of the melting point of steel. So we can dismiss the idea that the buildings collapsed because their steel melted. Most defenders of the official theory, to be sure, do not make this absurd claim. They say merely that the fire heated the steel up to the point where it lost so much of its strength that it buckled. For example, Thomas Eagar, saying that the steel loses 80% of its strength when it is heated to 1,300 degrees Fahrenheit, argues that this is what happened. But for even this claim to be plausible, the fires would have still had to be very hot. But they were not. People have made claims about the thousands of gallons of jet fuel that were poured into these buildings. But much of the fuel was burned up in the first few seconds in those tremendous fireballs. And the rest of it would have been burned up within 10 minutes. After which, the flames died down. Photographs of the towers 15 minutes after they were struck show few flames and lots of black smoke, a sign that the fires were oxygen-starved and therefore could not be very hot. Thomas Eagar, recognizing this fact, said that the fires were probably only about 1,200 or 1,300 degrees Fahrenheit. Moreover, there are reasons to believe they were not even nearly that hot. As photographs show, the fires did not break the windows or even spread much beyond their points of origins, suggesting that they were not hot enough to ignite paper, plastic, or wood. This photographic evidence is supported by scientific studies carried out by NIST itself, which indicated that they found no steel that had been exposed to temperatures more than 500 degrees Fahrenheit. Moreover, even if the fires had reached the temperature of 1,300 degrees Fahrenheit, as Eagar supposes, that does not mean any of the steel would have gotten that hot. Steel is an excellent conductor of heat. Put a fire to a bar of steel, and the heat will diffuse throughout the steel and to any other pieces of steel to which it is connected. For fires to have heated any of the steel columns to anywhere close to the temperature of the fires, they would have needed to be very big relative to the size of the building and the amount of steel in it. And of course, the Twin Towers were huge buildings with an enormous amount of steel. A small localized fire of 1,300 degrees would never have heated any of the steel columns, even close to that temperature, because the heat would have quickly dispersed throughout the rest of the building. Defenders of the official theory have said that the fires were indeed very big, turning the buildings into towering infernos. But all the evidence counts against this claim, especially with regard to the South Tower, which collapsed first. The South Tower was struck between floors 78 and 84. So that is where the fire would have been the biggest. And yet Brian Clark, a survivor, said that when he got down to the 80th floor, you could see through the wall and the cracks and see flames just licking up, not a roaring inferno, just quiet flames licking up and the smoke sort of eking through the wall. Likewise, one of the fire chiefs, who had reached the 78th floor, found only two isolated pockets of fire. The North Tower, to be sure, did have fires that were big enough and hot enough to cause people to jump to their deaths. But as anyone with a fireplace grate or even a potbelly stove knows, fire that will not harm steel or even iron will burn human flesh. In any case, the fires to weaken the steel columns would have needed not only to be very big and very hot, but also very long-lasting. The public was told that the fires had this characteristic, with CNN saying that very intense fires burn for a long time. But they did not. The North Tower collapsed an hour and 42 minutes after it was struck. The South Tower collapsed after only 56 minutes. To see how ludicrous is the claim that the short-lived fires in the towers could have induced structural collapse, we can compare them with some other fires. In 1988, a fire in the first Interstate Bank building in Los Angeles raged for 3.5 hours and gutted five of this building's 62 floors, but there was no significant structural damage. In 1991, a huge fire in Philadelphia's One Meridian Plaza lasted for 18 hours and gutted 8 of the building's 38 floors. But, said the FEMA report, although beams and girders sagged and twisted under severe fire exposure, the columns continued to support their loads without obvious damage. In Caracas in 2004, a fire in a 50-story building raged for 17 hours, completely gutting the building's top 20 floors, and yet it did not collapse. Unlike the fires in the towers, moreover, all of these fires were hot enough to break windows. Perhaps the most decisive comparison is provided by a series of experiments run in Great Britain in the mid-1990s to see what kind of damage could be induced in buildings by subjecting them to extremely hot, all-consuming, long-lasting fires. FEMA, having reviewed these experiments, said, despite the temperature of the steel beams reaching 1500 to 1700 degrees Fahrenheit, in 3 of the tests, no collapse was observed in any of the experiments. These facts bring out the absurdity of NIST's claim that the towers collapsed because the planes knocked the fireproofing off the steel columns. Fireproofing provides protection for only a few hours. So the steel in the buildings in Philadelphia and Caracas would have been directly exposed to raging fires for 14 or 15 hours without any fireproofing left. And yet this steel did not buckle. It is absurd to say the steel in the South Tower buckled because it was directly exposed to flames for 56 minutes. There is reverse truth to the fact that, aside from the alleged cases of 9/11, fire has never caused large steel frame buildings to collapse. This reverse truth is that every previous collapse has been caused by the procedure known as controlled demolition, in which explosives capable of cutting steel have been placed in crucial places throughout the building and then set off in a particular order. Therefore, just from knowing that the towers collapsed, the a priori assumption would be that they were brought down by controlled demolition. And this a priori assumption is supported also by the particular nature of the collapses. Here we come to the second major problem in the official theory, namely that the collapses had at least 10 characteristics that come with controlled demolition. I will now briefly indicate those 10 characteristics. First, in controlled demolition, the onset of the collapse is sudden. One moment the building is perfectly motionless, the next moment it suddenly begins to collapse. But steel, when heated, does not suddenly buckle or break. So in fire-induced collapses, if we had ever had any examples of such, the onset would be gradual. Horizontal beams and trusses would begin to sag. Vertical columns, if subjected to strong forces, would begin to bend. But as videos of the towers show, there were no signs of bending or sagging, even on the floors just above the damage caused by the impact of the airplanes. The buildings were perfectly motionless up till the moment they began to collapse. Second, the most important thing, by the way, about halfway through, we're going to run some videos that'll show you the towers and also Building 7, which I'll talk about later. So you might want to make a note of these 10 characteristics and then see how many of them you can observe in the video. So the first was sudden onset. Second, the most important thing in a controlled demolition of a tall building that is near other buildings is that it comes straight down into or at least close to the building's own footprint so that it does not destroy the surrounding buildings. The whole art or science of controlled demolition is oriented primarily around this goal, as Mark Loiseau, the president of Controlled Demolition Incorporated, has explained, to bring a building down as we want so no other structure is harmed, the demolition must be completely planned using the right explosives and the right pattern of laying the charges. If the 110-story Twin Towers had fallen over, they would have caused an enormous amount of damage in Lower Manhattan. But the towers came straight down. The official theory, therefore, requires a miracle, with fire-producing collapses that perfectly mimicked the kind of collapses that have otherwise been produced only by precisely placed explosives. Third, buildings brought down by controlled demolition collapse at almost free fall speed. This can occur because the supports for the lower floors are destroyed, so that when the upper floors come down, they encounter no resistance. The fact that the collapses of the towers mimic this feature of controlled demolition was indirectly mentioned by the 9/11 Commission, which said that the South Tower collapsed in 10 seconds. Now, actually, that's some exaggeration. It was closer to 14 seconds. But in any case, the authors of the report thought, evidently, that this very rapid collapse did not conflict with the official theory, which is a pancake theory, according to which the floors above the hole created by the impact of the airplane collapsed on the floor below it, bringing their weight and down, and then they pancaked all the way down. But if that's what happened, the lower floors, with all their steel and concrete, would have provided some resistance. The upper floors could not have fallen through them at the same speed as they would fall through the air. And yet the videos of the collapses show that the rubble falling inside the building's profile falls at the same speed as the rubble falling outside the building's profile. Fourth, the official theory is even more decisively ruled out by the fact that the collapses were total. These 110-story buildings collapsed into piles of rubble no more than a few stories high. According to the pancake theory, the horizontal steel supports broke free from the vertical columns, and that allowed the floors to pancake down. But if that is what happened, it would have been like the old 78 phonographs in which the records fell, but the spindle still sticking up in the air. The 9/11 Commission came up with a bold solution to this problem. The problem, of course, is that the core of each building had not just a spindle, but 47 of them, 47 massive steel columns. The bold solution of the 9/11 Commission was simply to deny the existence of those columns. It said, the interior core of the building was a hollow steel shaft in which elevators and stairwells were grouped. Voila! No core columns, most serious problem with total collapse solved. NIST's report handled this most difficult problem by claiming that when the floors collapsed, they pulled on the core columns and the perimeter columns, causing the perimeter columns to become unstable. This instability then increased the gravity load on the core columns, which had been weakened by tremendously hot fires in the core, which NIST claims reached 1,832 degrees Fahrenheit, and this combination of factors somehow produced global collapse, their word for total collapse. Well, of course, one problem with this is that there's no evidence whatsoever for those tremendously hot fires of 1,832 degrees. As I said earlier, NIST found evidence only of temperatures of 500 degrees, so they added more than 1,300 degrees with pure speculation. But even worse than that, even if they could have made a case for that, that would have provided no explanation whatsoever for this theory of total collapse. The NIST report asserts that column failure occurred in the core as well as the perimeter columns. But this remains a bare assertion. There is no plausible explanation with anything close to scientific rigor about how such column failure could have occurred. 5. In controlled demolitions of steel frame buildings, explosives are used to slice the steel columns and beams into pieces. A representative from Controlled Demolition, Inc. has said of RDX, one of the commonly used high explosives, that it slices steel like a razor blade through a tomato. The steel, moreover, is not merely sliced. It is sliced into manageable lengths. As Controlled Demolition, Inc. says in its publicity, our system segments steel components into pieces matching the lifting capacity of the available equipment. The collapses of the Twin Towers magically mimicked this feature of controlled demolitions also. Jim Hoffman, after studying various photos of the collapsed site, said that much of the steel seemed to be chopped up into sections that could be easily loaded onto the equipment that was cleaning up Ground Zero.
That concludes part one of a three-part series of The Destruction of the Trade Towers, a lecture by David Ray Griffin in New York City. The event sponsors are WBAI 99.5 FM, New York City, Muchka, Muslim Christian Jewish Alliance, and New York 9/11 Truth. For CD copies of this lecture, contact the sponsor. Email address info@ny911truth.org. Phone number 212-714-7147. For details of this program, you can contact KBOO Radio at 503-231-8032. Part 2 of this program airs next week, Thursday, February 2nd at 10 a.m., and Part 3 the following Thursday, February 9th. Special thanks go to Catherine Davis, Public Affairs Director at WBAI New York. This is Mal Resler, your host for this segment of the Thursday Radio Zine.